two guys were sitting in the back row, and they saw the pastor take off his watch and put it on the thing, and he turned to his friend and said, "What does it mean when the pastor takes his watch off and puts it on the desk?" And the guy looked back at him and said, "Absolutely nothing." I promise I won't be here for hours. In the classic motion picture Tombstone, Kurt Russell plays the legendary Wyatt Earp. Many of you have probably seen the movie. And Val Kilmer plays his sidekick, his wingman, Doc Holliday. Doc Holliday is dying of tuberculosis. And yet, he seemingly gets up off his deathbed at one point in the movie to save the life of his friend Wyatt from a gunfight that Wyatt can't win. And then he goes on and he joins Wyatt on a ride with a posse to eliminate the scourge of an outlaw gang known as the Cowboys, who had been terrorizing the area around Tombstone. In one scene, the posse has stopped. You want to flip that up there? There, and they are resting. And Doc Holliday is lying there coughing, smoking a cigarette. And he gets up and he takes a couple steps and he starts coughing. He's literally coughing his lungs up. And Turkey Creek Johnson, the fellow in the blue shirt, looks at him and he says, "Doc, what are you doing out here?" In fairly colorful language, mind you. "What are you doing out here? You shouldn't be out here. You should be at home. Why are you here?" And Doc Holliday looks at him and he says, "Because Wyatt Earp is my friend." And Turkey Creek Johnson says, "Well, heck, I've got lots of friends." To which Holliday says, "I don't." Friends. I think friends is one of those words that in the culture we're living in is suffering from what linguists call verbal inflation. Verbal inflation. It's a thing. It's, in fact, what they say it is when a word gets used or overused or abused so much, it loses its weight. It loses its meaning. It doesn't really stand for anything. Let me give you an example. When God created the universe, when he was done, he stood back. I can just imagine him looking at all he had created, and he said, "It's good." He didn't say it was awesome. He didn't say it was amazing. It was epic. Which it was, all of those things. But we talk in language today saying those things about burritos. They were awesome. Now, and I do it. I'm not, I mean, it's part of the language of the culture. I get it. But Doc Holliday's definition of a friend is not the same as the Facebook definition of a friend. I have 54 friends on Facebook. And that, you know, from what I can tell, that's not all that many. I mean, it's kind of pretty average. But I have 544 friends on Facebook. And I would tell you that there are at least a quarter of them, I'm not sure I really know who they are. There might be a friend of a friend. I always check to see how many mutual friends we have. And that idea has been lost. Doc Holliday's definition of a friend was more than that. So this morning, I'm going to try to do something fairly simple, and that is to try to elevate our view of true friendship and what it really is about in a biblical sense. Maybe even try to elevate it to the level of amazing or epic. You know, we talk a lot about 2 a.m. friends around here. Friends that you could call any day or time of night, and they would come. And I'm convinced that we all want to have those kind of friends. We all want those. In fact, we are suffering, I believe, from an epidemic of friendlessness in our country. A study done in 2024 indicated that 15% of all men in America today have no close friends, by self-admission. And if you're under the age of 30, that number jumps to 28% have no close friends. We are in an epidemic of loneliness in our culture, and it's part of what is tearing our culture apart, I believe. 57% of men have said they often feel lonely most of the time. 57%. And you might be thinking to yourself, man, you guys have got a problem. But 59% of women say that they are lonely most of the time. Howard Hughes, the great billionaire industrialist of the last century, at one point was estimated to be worth $4 billion in 1950 dollars. And he said he would give it all up for one good friend. Now, I know we would like to have those kind of friends. But to find those kind of friends, the best way, I believe, to find those kinds of friends is to be that kind of friend. And to be that kind of friend, it's good to see that kind of friend in action, isn't it? This morning, we're going to meet one of those people. David had a friend like that. And his name is Jonathan. We're going to meet him this morning in 1 Samuel chapter 18. If you have your Bible, open it up to 1 Samuel 18. 1 Samuel is in the Old Testament, first part of your Bible. You go through the Pentateuch, the first five books, Joshua, Judges, Ruth, 1 Samuel. In the story of David, and we pick the story of David up, and David and Jonathan up, in right at the end of chapter 18. Let me set the scene. David has arrived on the scene of a standoff between the Philistine army and the Israelite army. And he arrives by bringing supplies to his brother. And his brothers who were serving in the army. And of course, the story goes that the champion for the Philistines is the famous Goliath. And David sees him, and everybody's afraid, and David kind of looks around and says, well, I'll take him on. And lo and behold, he slays Goliath. And of course, that's, you know, the story we remember. But the story goes on. In verse 57 of chapter 17, we read, so when David returned from the killing of the Philistine, Goliath, Abner, who was a general for Saul, the king of Israel, took him and brought him before Saul with the Philistine's head still in his hand. I brought you a present. Saul looks at him and he says, whose son are you, young man? And David says, I am the son of your servant Jesse, the Bethlehemite. And so immediately Saul knows this is a kid from the sticks. Because Bethlehem was not, you know, it was out there, okay? And he says, now when it came about, when he had finished speaking to Saul, chapter 1, verse 18, that the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David. The NIV translates that they were one in spirit. They were bonded together. There was something that occurred that linked the heart of Jonathan to David. And it says, and he loved him as himself. And this is where we have to be careful that this is not some sort of strange, immoral perversion. This is a brotherly love. The word means an esteemed, beloved friend, a beloved brother, as you would. And Jonathan surely had seen what had happened. And his admiration and his respect for David must have just been elevated when he saw this young guy who was probably in his teens. He was not a, he was, in fact, Saul, they refer to him as in his youth, something that I'm not anywhere close to anymore. And Jonathan had already been in the army. He had fought battles, he had won battles, and he was a courageous individual, passionate for the kingdom of his father and the glory of God. And so he's kind of like a big brother to David. You know, there may have been, I don't know, maybe 10 years difference. We don't know. But Jonathan was most surely in his 20s. David was probably in his teens. He was a big brother. And Jonathan, when he sees him, his heart is drawn to him. There's something about David that he just, it resonates with him. And so then in verse 3, we read, Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself. And then Jonathan does something very strange. He takes off the robe that he was wearing, the royal robe as the crown prince of Israel, and he hands it to David. And then he takes off his armor and his sword and his bow and his belt that holds them all together, and he gives them as a gift, as a symbol of this affection and this commitment to David. It's as though Jonathan somehow even knows that he will probably never be king. And it's almost as if he knows that David will be. He makes an incredible commitment. He had watched what had happened. And I think when he sees the way David stands up to the giant. Now, remember, I don't know if you've ever, have you seen any of the NCAA tournament or a basketball tournaments recently? They have these people interviewing the players. And there's this one shot where there's this nice lady who's probably 4'11" standing next to this basketball player who's 6'10". You know, she comes up to about here. That's probably the way this looked. I mean, David walked up to this guy, and instead of being afraid, which everybody was else, he puts Saul's sword down that Saul had given him. He picks up a stick and five stones. He walks out to face Goliath, and Goliath says, "What are you sending this dog out here?" And this is what David says. David said to the Philistine, "You come to me with a sword and a spear and a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord God of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel." And this, all this assembly may know that the Lord, then the Lord this day will deliver you into my hands, and I will strike you down and remove your head from you. This guy's got some guts. I mean, David, you better back it up. Of course, we know for the story, he does. Well, Jonathan had seen this. He had probably heard him say this. And so it says his heart was filled with admiration because here was a brother, somebody who shared his passion for God and for the kingdom. And so he makes this enormous commitment. He gives him the symbols of royal stature and royal power as a gift. If you want to be a 2 a.m. friend, if you want 2 a.m. friends, if you want to be a 2 a.m. friend, you need to understand that 2 a.m. friendships are rooted in a unilateral commitment to the other person. This is not a transactional convenience. So many friendships in our society are, what can you do for me? And there was nothing Jonathan could gain from this. There was nothing. This was a shepherd boy from a poor family in the sticks. And yet Jonathan takes the initiative. The crown prince humbles himself. And he says, you know what? I'm going to bless you My goal in our relationship is to bless you, to lift, not put you down to lift me up, but to lift you up. Do you think of your friends that way? How can I lift them up? How can I make them look better? How can I make their life look better? And by the way, Jonathan is one who took the initiative. When was the last time you took the initiative to reach out to somebody to benefit them? You see, we're also lonely, I think, because we're waiting for everybody else to what? Come to me. Come to me. I want for that. But you know what? You know when you get that need met? It's when you take the initiative to reach out to them and to befriend them. This was not quid pro quo. He said, how can I, not even how can I bless you, but here's how I'm going to bless you, David. Rather than how can you benefit me. You see, what I've discovered is me first relationships inevitably collapse. They inevitably collapse. If I'm the one who's the center of it all, and I want you to come to me, inevitably people are going to get tired of that. Selfishness doesn't build relationships, it destroys relationships. So if we're going to be 2 a.m. friends, it's going to be rooted in a commitment to give and to build the other person up. And that's important. And that's important when circumstances and people complicate things, which they were about to do in chapter 18. So let me just distill what happens from here. He brings David in to live in the palace because he promised whoever would slay the giant would get his daughter's hand in marriage. Now, David was probably still a little young for that, but that was the deal. So he brings him in to sort of be a part of the palace. And it isn't very long, and Saul starts to get jealous of David's celebrity. I mean, everywhere, he's the greatest. You know, Saul got his thousands, but David got his 10,000s. And he becomes afraid, he becomes angry, he becomes jealous that somebody else is getting the attention. And so David is playing the harp one day, and Saul throws a spear trying to kill him. And you begin to see the beginnings of Saul losing his mind, basically. Later, he then figures, after, you know, David escapes, and he figures, well, what maybe what I can do is I'll give him my one daughter to be married, and then I can manipulate him. But David backs away and says, no, I don't really want that, because I'm just a poor boy from the sticks. And then he discovers that he has another daughter. Her name is Michal, and she's in love with David. He thinks, huh. Well, he's poor, he doesn't have a dowry. I know what I'll do. I'll promise him I'll give him Michal if he will go out and kill 1,000 Philistines and bring me a gift back as his dowry. And he thinks, he'll get killed and the Philistines will kill him and then I'll be rid of him and it'll all be great. This is the Benedum loose translation version. But what happens is, of course, David comes through swimmingly. He wins the victory. He comes home, and he ends up with Michal now as his wife. And Saul's anger grows deeper and deeper and deeper. Now, it came about, verse 18, let's skip forward to verse 18. I'm getting myself confused here. Chapter 19, verse 1. Saul is starting to lose it. So now Saul told Jonathan, his son, and all his servants to put David to death. But Jonathan, Saul's son, greatly delighted in David. So Jonathan told David, saying, Saul, my father, is seeking to put you to death. Now, therefore, please be on your guard in the morning and stay in that secret place that you hid yourself. I will go out and stand beside my father in the field where you are, and I will speak with my father about you, and I will find out anything, and if I find out anything, I will tell you. And then Jonathan spoke well of David to Saul, his father, and said to him, do not let the king sin against your servant David, since he was not sinned against you, and since his deeds have been very beneficial to you. For he took his life in his hand and he struck the Philistine. And the Lord brought about a great deliverance for all of Israel. You saw it and you rejoiced. Why then will you sin against your innocent blood by putting David to death? Now let me just stop there for a second. Jonathan is willing to speak truth to power. He's taken a risk going to his father and saying, Why are you trying to destroy this man? He's done nothing but good for you. Life gets complicated sometimes, not only for David, but for Jonathan. I'm reminded of what Jesus said in John chapter 16 in verse 33. He said, in this world you will have sunshine, rainbows, and unicorns. No, he didn't say that, did he? He said, in this world, you're going to have trouble. With a capital T, that rhymes with, no, I'm not going to do that. Trouble. You're going to have adversity. You're going to have struggle. Life is not going to be easy for you. And I think as Christians, sometimes we really do think that if once I become a Christian, everything's going to be great. Everything's going to be great. Once I do all these good things, why are all these bad things happening to me? See, struggles are when we need 2 a.m. friends. Jonathan was not a good time Charlie. You know, as soon as the bad times come, he was gone. No, he's got David's back. He stands up to his father. He stands up to power and he speaks truth. Why are you doing this? And he defends him and he gives him good reasons why. You see, we're surprised at struggle. We're surprised at adversity. And we shouldn't be. Men and women, we are in the greatest struggle of the ages. We are in the process of reclaiming a dying world from a ferocious, terrifying enemy, and he's not human. And we're doing it one life, one relationship at a time. Every relationship that you have is a part of that struggle if you are a member of the body of Christ. Because every relationship is an opportunity to be salt and light in people's lives. Not only can this relationship of a 2 a.m. friend change hearts, but it can change history. So here's the second thing you need to know about being a 2 a.m. friend. If you're going to be a 2 a.m. friend, 2 a.m. friendships deepen through seasons of shared adversity. When you go through trials together with others that you love and you care about, you link arms like a band of brothers, we would say, or a band of sisters. That we link arms together and we don't run away and we don't let the struggle split us apart, but we stand together to face it and we stand shoulder to shoulder and back to back to defend one another. And when we do that, when we love somebody that way, it changes hearts. It can soften people's hearts. In fact, look at verse 6 again in chapter 19. Saul, we are told, listened to Jonathan, the voice of Jonathan, and Saul vowed, as the Lord lives, he shall not be put to death. Saul's heart was changed as a result, at least temporarily. But not only that, but history was changed because of that. Now, why do I say that? Because had he not had a friend like Jonathan, there never would have been a King David. Saul would have certainly killed David had he not had a friend like him to stand with him. Jonathan's love for his friend was free of jealousy and envy. Unlike his father Saul, the glory of God was more important to him than any political kingdom. And men and women, we are a part of a God-sized cause, a God-sized struggle. And what we're doing may seem inconsequential. What you're about in your everyday life and the people you interact with, you might think, well, this is inconsequential in terms of the big picture. But men and women, friendship is not a big thing. It's a million little things that we do over time. It's that when you walk into the gym and you're listening to your favorite oldie station, and there's a fellow or an individual there that always wants to talk to you when, because they're lonely. So you take the earbuds out and you listen and you talk and you discover that they're an atheist, but you have an opportunity to be a loving face of Jesus in their life. It's when you bring a meal to somebody. It's when you reach out and help someone that you don't have to help. You help them move. You bring a small gift. All these little things that we think of that are just inconsequential, men and women, they can change the course of history, as it was shown here. So Jonathan's love for his friend softened his father's heart. He relents, at least for a time. But unfortunately, it wouldn't last, because not long after that, for a second time, Saul hurls a spear at David and he tries to kill him. And at this point, you know, David is a victim of that old adage that no good deed goes unpunished. All I've done is good things for Saul, and all he's trying to do is kill me. I don't get that. What's wrong with this, Lord? Well, God works in mysterious ways. So he goes, as Saul's jealousy becomes more and more literally demonic, he gets more and more out of control. His sanity is slipping away from him, that even the staff in the palace begin to see that. And so David and Jonathan make a plan. They get together and they say, okay, there's a festival coming up and you're in hiding, David. And when you don't show up, how my father reacts is going to be a good test of whether there's any opportunity for this to reconcile. So in chapter 20, verse 18, we read, then Jonathan said to him, tomorrow is the new moon, and you will be missed because your seat will be empty at the table there. And when you have stayed for 3 days, you shall go down quickly and come to the place where you hid yourself before on that eventful day. You shall remain by the stone Ezel. I will shoot 3 arrows to the side as though I was shooting at a target. After Jonathan has talked to his dad a little further, and he says, I will shoot it, and behold, I will send the lad saying, go find the arrows. And if I specifically say to you, behold, the arrows are on the side of you, that means you're okay. But he says, if the arrows go beyond you, then you'll know it's time to go, basically. If I say to the youth, behold, the arrow are going beyond you, for the Lord has sent you away. And as for the agreement of which you and I, Jonathan and David, have spoken, behold, the Lord is between you and me forever. He knows that if this goes sideways, it might be that they might not be able to see each other anymore. So they go to the table. David's not there. Saul goes ballistic, starts to accuse Jonathan of being against him. And in verse 33, he gets so furious, he throws a spear at his own son, trying to kill him. You'd think they would have gotten it by this time. And finally they do. So then that day he shoots the arrows. They go beyond him. As the boy goes to get them, David steps out from behind the stone. And when the lad had gone, verse 41, David rose from the south side and fell on his face on the ground and bowed three times. And they kissed each other and they wept together. But David wept more. Jonathan said to David, "Go in safety, inasmuch as we have sworn to each other in the name of the Lord, saying, 'The Lord will be between me and you, and between my descendants and your descendants forever.'" We're going to see that worked out next Sunday, by the way. "Then he rose and departed, while Jonathan went back to the city." This was probably the last time that David and Jonathan saw each other this side of eternity. But what it shows us is that 2 a.m. friendships are costly. It's going to cost you something to be a 2 a.m. friend. But they endure a lifetime. I have friends that I haven't seen in years that I know if I called them tonight and said, "I need help," they would move heaven and earth to come and be at my side. One of these friends was best man in my wedding. I hadn't talked to him, hadn't seen him in probably over 20 years. We called him up last year, decided to get together for coffee. And we got together, we sat down, and it was like we had never left each other. The relationship just picked right up where it left off. I was like, "Oh, this is amazing." Because our hearts were knit together. Our hearts beat for the same things. Jonathan's display of sacrificial loyalty to David was amazing in itself, but he was also loyal to his father. And eventually he would die in battle with his father in chapter 31 of 1 Samuel. But that friendship that had been established cost him so much. It cost him certain relationships, I'm sure, and certain privileges that his father would have given him. But it doesn't matter, because those are the kinds of relationships that will endure. So as we make a commitment to bless others, one directional, as we go through times of shared adversity, that relationship will deepen. And then we realize it's going to cost me, but I know that the silver lining is it will last for, our relationship will be a lifetime. And you know what? We're going to be able to pick it up again in eternity. Amen. So here's three takeaways. I want you to, I'm big on three things. You know, somebody says, "Why aren't there four? Why aren't there five?" Because most people can't remember more than three. I can't remember more than three. So I'll give you three. Three takeaways about 2 a.m. friendships. First of all, 2 a.m. friendships take time. They take time. You can't microwave them. And they occur in small acts of kindness and loyalty and service, and often over years, not hours. John 15:13, Jesus said, "No greater love has anyone that they lay down their life for the friend." You only can die for your friend once, but you can lay down your agenda on a daily basis. Because your goal is to bless them, not for them to bless you. Okay? They take time. Be patient. Be persistent. Not only that, they take trust. We have to have trust. Trust is in God first and trust in each other. Because trust is the relational bedrock of relationships. If you don't have trust, you won't have a relationship. And I can't affect whether you're going to be a trustworthy person, but I can seek to be a trustworthy person. If you want people to trust you, be trustworthy. Show up when you say you're going to show up. And if you can't make it, call or text or do something. Let them know. That's being trustworthy. Pay your taxes. I know, April 15th is coming. Pay your taxes. Don't cheat the government. Don't defraud people. Even if you can justify it in your mind, it's not a big deal. Don't do it. Your trust is worth more than that. Okay? Become a trustworthy person. You won't do it perfectly. None of us do. But make that your goal, to be a trustworthy person. Thirdly, they take truth. Truth is one of those words that is suffering from linguistic or verbal inflation. Without truth, without a consistent view of this is real, this is what happened. If there is no truth, there is no trust. And if there's no trust, there's no relationship. Without truth and trust, relationships collapse, and so do societies. Seek to be a person of integrity. Seek to be a person of truth, as best you understand the truth. Live and consistent with what you know is reality about life. And you'll begin to develop these characteristics. And when you are a 2 a.m. friend to some of your unbelieving friends, when you develop that kind of relationship with them, when you actually do speak to them, your words are going to carry weight. They are going to have impact because they know it comes from a heart of love. I close with this. When Harry Truman left the White House, he was very much a common man. He drove his own car, his green Chrysler. He and his wife drove from Washington, D.C. back to Missouri. And he was a private citizen. He strikes up a relationship with a Presbyterian pastor there. And one day the Presbyterian pastor is called to do a burial service for an elderly gentleman that they both knew. It was a cold day. It was a bitter day. It was a wind-whipped, nasty day. And the pastor stood at the side of the grave, and no one showed up. Until a green Chrysler pulled up. And out of that Chrysler comes one Secret Service agent and Harry Truman with his cane, making his way to the graveside, standing there. And at the appropriate time, the pastor did the service, and of course it ended very quickly. But on their way back to the car, the pastor turned to Harry and he said, "Harry, why are you here? It's cold. You're old. You should be home. Why are you here?" Sound familiar? Truman looked at him through those thick glasses he wore, and he said, "Pastor, I never forget a friend. I never forget a friend. I pray that people would say that about our lives, about my life. Because nobody is a nobody to God."